everyone. Welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Cook. Captain Brusick, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
Major Washburn, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Michael James Brusick, and I, along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, we represent Airman Jacalian Cook. Your Honor, before proceeding, respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Airman Cook's substantial right to be sentenced by a court-martial possessing a correct calculation of his punitive exposure was materially prejudiced when the military judge miscalculated the maximum penalty for the offense of transporting aliens by 5 times the amount that was permitted in this case. This court should set aside the sentence and should do so for 2 reasons. First, the military judge committed plain error by failing to take into account the compound charging scheme that the government chose to employ against Airman Cook. And second, because the military judge had the primary responsibility for correctly calculating the maximum penalty before entering a sentence, this was a matter that Airman Cook could not waive. And so I would like to begin the discussion by focusing...
If I may, Captain Brusick, I'd like to ask you a question up front. From your perspective, is it a binary situation where if there is any miscalculation of the maximum authorized punishment, then that renders the sentencing proceedings fundamentally unfair?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, and I'm just trying to make sure I understand. So let's say, for the sake of argument, not this case, that the maximum authorized punishment is 50 years, and military judge were to incorrectly calculate it as 51 years, that renders the proceedings fundamentally unfair.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, if I may, I'd like to pose to you the following question, and I'd ask you to fill in the blank. A miscalculation of a maximum authorized punishment renders a sentencing proceeding fundamentally unfair because?
Your Honor, this relates to what the Supreme Court described in Rosales Morales, that any confinement beyond what is necessary or beyond the permissible sentencing range is a severe issue. It's a severe error.
Now, that's beyond the sentencing range. Now, in this case, we're talking about a situation where the sentence was not beyond the maximum authorized punishment.
That is correct, Your Honor. But the issue is the reasonable probability that the sentence imposed was tainted by that misunderstanding of what the maximum potential penalty was.
Now, where does that taint come from? I'm looking at the code, and it talks about the fact that under 56C1, it tells military judge how to — it's — the heading is imposition of sentence, and it informs a military judge about what to consider. And there it says that court-martial, quote, shall impose punishment that is sufficient but not greater than necessary to promote justice and to maintain good order and discipline. There's nothing in there and nothing else within the code anywhere else that would say that a military judge should contemplate what the maximum authorized punishment is. So why would a slight miscalculation affect the fairness of the proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor. To the extent that that misunderstanding raises a question of whether the sentence that the military judge did impose would have been the same had they had a correct understanding. This goes to the heart of what the Supreme Court discussed in Moreno-Martinez, which is the question of reasonable probability. Is it whether there's a reasonable probability the sentence would have been different. And what the Supreme Court lays out in that case is almost like a rebuttable presumption. Once that error has taken place, a reviewing court will struggle to know what the military judge would have imposed had they had a correct understanding.
So in that scenario, if you've got the 50 years, that's the correct maximum authorized punishment. The miscalculation is 51 years, and the military judge imposes 1 year. Where does that leave us? The sentencing proceeding still fundamentally unfair at that point?
Yes, Your Honor, it is unfair. It's unfair, again, because of this issue with the reasonable probability. What the Supreme Court described in Murillo-Martinez is whether there's anything else in the record that can give an indication that the military judge did have was not influenced by that misunderstanding. Now, much like the case before the court here today, the record is silent in terms of what the military judge did with that maximum sentence calculation, except to say that that was his understanding when he imposed the sentence that he did.
Judge Johnson,
counsel, I want to go back. Thank you, Chief Judge. I'd like to go back to Rosales-Morales because you cited to that, and one of the other propositions coming out of that case is that there are three factors. I need to put my glasses on. That there are three factors that an appellate court must consider before exercising any authority to correct a sentence. And those three factors or three conditions are that the error was not intentionally waived or abandoned, that the error must be plain, so it has to be clear and obvious, and that the error affected the defendant's substantial rights. So going back to factor number one, and you touched on it kind of in your overview, that the error was not intentionally waived. Why was this error not waived?
Your Honor, it wasn't waived because trial defense counsel's mere acquiescence to the miscalculation offered by the government and the military judge was not sufficient to affect waiver. When talking about waiver, there's essentially two prongs to simplify the issue. The first is, what is the nature of the right? And then the second is, what is the procedure that has to take place on the record for that waiver to occur? So if we're dealing with what this court has referred to as a substantial right in United States versus Saint Blanc, a substantial right to be sentenced based on that correct understanding of the maximum penalty, we're not in the realm where trial defense counsel's acquiescence is sufficient to achieve that waiver. On one end, we have rights which can never be waived, like jurisdiction, for example. On the other hand, we have matters that may fall within trial defense counsel's strategy. And so in those instances, for example, the admission of evidence or something of that nature, which is otherwise objectionable. But within the trial defense strategy, trial defense counsel decides, I'm not going to object to this. That's sort of our other bookend. Somewhere in between is where the right has to be knowing and intelligently waived by the accused. And in this case, it's hard to conceive of a situation where an accused would knowingly and intelligently waive the right to be sentenced based on a lower level of punitive exposure. That would consist of the military judge speaking to the accused and saying, I understand you have a right to be sentenced based on this lower threshold, but you can waive that and be sentenced by a higher threshold. It's sort of inconceivable why there would be any strategic benefit to doing that. But to return to your question, Your Honor, this falls within the realm of Article 59. It falls within the realm of a substantial right, which in this case did materially prejudice the sentence which was imposed because it created a reasonable probability that the sentence imposed was influenced by that misunderstanding.
Just as a follow-up then, with regards to that substantial right and that issue, so you were saying that counsel cannot waive this, and along your continuum, along that same continuum, the Supreme Court says you can waive the elements of the offense. And so a proper recitation of the elements of the offense, and whereas that is waivable, why would not a miscalculation of a maximum potential sentence be waivable? How is that more or less substantial?
Your Honor, it ultimately goes to the issue of how this fits into trial defense strategy such that there is the potential for waiver. So reading of an element in a certain matter could be subject to waiver if that somehow advances the trial strategy. But importantly, here, there is no trial strategy advanced by a misunderstanding of Airman Cook's punitive exposure.
Well, could not the strategy be, I'm going to remain mute and then attempt to appeal it?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
Couldn't part of the strategy be, okay, it's wrong, I know it's a miscalculation, I'm not going to object, and then I will just appeal it?
Your Honor, it's hard to conceive how that could be a strategy, being that this is something the military judge has to get right. It's a binary question. Either that maximum penalty calculation is correct or it's incorrect. It can't be correct enough. And insofar as Airman Cook is concerned, he's been in confinement. He has served his sentence. Now here he is now looking at relief that isn't necessarily going to change his immediate circumstances. Granted, a recalculation of the sentence can have an impact, but in terms of sort of planting an issue to raise it at a later point in time, that doesn't really advance a strategic purpose. And so, ultimately, the issue here, in terms of the error that the military judge committed...
Captain Brucey, before you move on, just to make sure I understand your reasonable probability theory. In other words, it seems to focus on assuming that the military judge during the sentence determination or deliberations is beginning with the maximum punishment. But in the days before we had military judge sentencing alone, and the members were sentencing, I believe the members were given an instruction that when they vote, they must vote on the sentence, proposed sentences beginning with the least severe. Now, that's my understanding. I could be wrong, you know. Been a long time since I tried a court-martial, but so first my question to you is that my understanding of your reasonable probability approach? In other words, am I wrong in assuming that your position kind of assumes the military judge is beginning with the maximum and then working down, when in fact previously members were told to begin with the least severe and move up? And the only reason I bring it up is because if that's what members were told in the good old days, or the bad old days, depending on who you are, I suppose, if that's what the members were told, then why can't we assume that a military judge does likewise when he or she is considering the sentence?
Your Honor, we can't necessarily assume that in light of the landscape created by Moreno-Martinez with the United States Supreme Court. And the minimum potential sentence and the maximum potential sentence, both of those are important considerations.
Well, the minimum would always be zero, aside from cases that have a mandatory minimum in them, wouldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And to clarify, specifically with regard to the lowest sentence necessary to address the misconduct. What the Supreme Court describes with regard to the maximum sentencing range is that is a benchmark. That's an important benchmark that the military judge takes into consideration. And so when we talk about reasonable probability, it begins with that understanding that there's a reasonable probability that the military judge used that miscalculation. And then
what I'm trying to get at is, am I wrong in assuming that your position depends on the military judge considering the max first and then working downward?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. It's the totality of the sentencing range. And perhaps the military judge begins at the bottom, but the maximum penalty is still a consideration that went into the sentencing in this case, because the military judge on the record said it's 25 years. So that's the benchmark.
If you're conceding that the military judge could in fact begin at the bottom, zero punishment, no punishment, then I guess I'm not sure I understand how significant the error on the maximum punishment would be.
And, Your Honor, we're not conceding that he began at the bottom.
I understand.
When we look at the record, it's silence with regard to how this maximum sentence calculation was taken into consideration. And so, per the United States Supreme Court, that's where that reasonable probability comes into consideration in terms of whether the sentence imposed is what would have been imposed had he had a correct understanding of the maximum sentence. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court goes on to explain that it would be unusual circumstances where a military judge would have that miscalculation and would still enter a sentence without being influenced by it.
Well, the Supreme Court cases are generally talking about federal or state sentencing schemes, are they not?
Yes, Your Honor, they are.
All of which are very different from our system in the military. Would you not agree?
I would agree, Your Honor, yes. It's quite different. But the principle of whether or not a misunderstanding of that maximum punitive exposure is an element in the military judge's consideration, that applies regardless of whether we're looking at the sentencing guidelines or we're looking at a maximum sentence calculation under Rule for Court-Martial 1003. And so ultimately what we have in this case is silence on the record. The military judge's discussion with regard to the maximum sentence is very limited. The military judge didn't even address the issue of the conspiracy specification, which also incorporated this federal offense as the object of the conspiracy. And so we're left without any indications that the military judge was not influenced, did not have that reasonable probability that the misunderstanding influenced the sentence that he imposed.
Counsel, can we go back to waiver? It seems to me that this case is like Davis in that it's not just so much a waiver or a forfeiture, but a question of inconsistent positions, what we might call judicial estoppel, the preclusion of taking one position at trial and then another position on appeal. It's not just so much that something blew by your client or you said and you had no objection, but appellant took the position at trial that the maximum punishment was 25 years. Concurred in that, said we concur, jointly prepared that and said that is our position, it's 25 years. And now you're on appeal saying it's 5 years. It seems like there's a judicial estoppel to say you can't take one position at trial and then another position on appeal, that this isn't so much just a waiver or a forfeiture, but it's just taking inconsistent positions. I mean, we wouldn't let the government do something like that. How can you take one position at trial and then switch your position on appeal?
Your Honor, I can see my time is just about up.
Please take your time to answer that important question.
Yes, Your Honor, and it is a very important question in this case. The reason it's not a matter of whether one position is taken at trial on the part of the accused and then a different position on appeal is because it's the military judge's primary responsibility to get this calculation correct.
But doesn't the military judge has to rely on the party's arguments? I mean, it seems a little odd. Should the military judge not ask the parties then what their positions are?
Your Honor, the military judge did ask the parties what their positions were, and then after receiving those positions said, I agree. So the military judge took ownership of it at that point, as a military judge should have done, because under United States versus Hardin, it's the military judge's primary responsibility to get the maximum sentence calculation correct. And so for that reason, it's not the type of issue that can be waived simply by trial defense counsel's acquiescence. And as it pertains to the question of Davis, Davis is something of a limited holding in light of this Court's decision, United States versus Schmidt, where there's a question if you have an unsettled area of law, that's not subject to waiver per United States versus Davis. But in this case, the military judge failed to recognize the duplicitous pleading, the compound pleading that the government employed. And what the military judge should have done is taken that into consideration and understood that in light of that, the maximum sentence which could be imposed for confinement was limited to 5 years. And Airman Cook could not waive that.
Further questions? Counsel, what do you want us to say about Davis? Do you want us to say that Davis doesn't apply because of the nature of the right at issue here, or do you want us to cabin Davis with more of your two-pronged analysis that says, well, the waiver or not is one question, but the importance of the right is a second question that Davis didn't mention, but we're going to mention now? If you were to win, what do you want this Court to say about Davis?
Your Honor, what's important about Davis, as is distinguishable from this case, is that Davis is an instructions case. And it's an instructions case where the instruction which was delivered comported with the law after it had become settled. And so, therefore, a novel challenge to the reading of the elements was not available on appeal. But, Your Honor, to answer your question, we would ask this Court to analyze it within the purview of Article 59, which is the question of what the substantial right is and how it's been materially prejudiced. And as this Court held in United States versus Saint Blanc, that miscalculation of the maximum sentence, that does relate to a substantial right, the substantial right to be sentenced based on a correct understanding of the punitive exposure. And the failure for the military judge to recognize that is materially prejudicial.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Brusick.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Washburn.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Major Tyler Washburn, and along with Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. Appellant affirmatively waived this issue on three occasions. Even if he had not, it is not plain error to follow the plain language of the statute. And before I get to the heart of the government's argument, I want to take a moment to respond to a few of the points that appellant just made here of an argument. First, while appellant argues that this was mere acquiescence to the military judge or the government, that's not what happened here. The initial proposition to the military judge for instructions on the maximum sentence computation came in the form of joint proposed instructions from both the defense and the government. And when asked, while those joint instructions were being introduced into the record, whether the defense agreed with that calculation, the appellant's defense counsel affirmatively stated, "Yes, Your Honor, that is accurate." That is not mere acquiescence. The appellant's defense counsel were not browbeaten into accepting this calculation. That calculation stemmed just as much from them as it did from the military judge and the government trial counsel. To answer a question that you posed, Chief Judge Olson, regarding whether this is a binary decision, is this simply, if there's a minor error, prejudice is per se? No, it's not, Your Honor. The question that this court should be asking itself is whether the error, whether it be a year, 5 years, 10 years, whether it had a substantial impact on appellant's sentence. And here, while appellant asserts that the record is silent as to how the maximum sentence computation was used, one thing that this court can be sure of is how it was not used. If this court looks to the government trial counsel's sentencing argument, the government's sentencing argument is entirely devoid of any reference to the maximum sentence computation. The government did not mention 25 years, it never leveraged 25 years, nor did it even acknowledge it in the typical standard way of saying, well, you know, Your Honor, the maximum sentence is 25 years, taking into consideration the mitigating and aggravating circumstances in this case, the government's arrived at its sentence recommendation. The government did none of those things. The government argued that 3 years was an appropriate sentence, and appellant didn't even get 3 years. And even if if you look at the 50-year maximum, assuming that's true, because it is, the appellant got nowhere close to that. But even if you accept appellant's argument that the 5-year computation of time was the appropriate level, he still got substantially less than the 5-year maximum. And there's no evidence that the judge was in any way influenced by that erroneous maximum sentence computation. The government didn't use it. Defense counsel, didn't fight against it at any point. And where there is no evidence to suggest that the military judge was substantially influenced in his decision-making, this court should find no problem.
But let's look on the other side of the equation here. 1953 case of United States versus Cooper. There, this court presumed prejudice and stated in doing so, we have no way of knowing what the sentence as regards confinement would have been had the court been instructed properly. Now, of course, we're talking about members. But why are we not in that same sphere where here sitting on appeal, we have no way of knowing what the sentence would have been if the maximum authorized punishment had been calculated correctly?
Well, Your Honor, I think first the law has evolved, but also the fact that this court can look to the record and feel with some confidence that the military judge made the right decision and that the sentence wouldn't have changed because he's sentencing on the same operative set of facts. And as Judge Sparks pointed out earlier, you're supposed to arrive at a sentence that is, sufficient but no greater than necessary to properly punish the crime that was committed. And, you know, appellant seems to assume that a military judge would start on the high end of the most severe and work his way down. But that's not how the justice system works, and that's not the how members are instructed, and that's not how the system operates, at least insofar as the military sphere is concerned. And because of that, because he's sentencing on the same operative set of facts, and regardless of whether the maximum was 50 years or 25 years or 5 years, he's sentencing on the same operative set of facts, and as long as his decision fell within the ambit of what is statutorily authorized, this court should see no or have no concerns. But I also want to take
Major Washburn, before you move on the issue of whether or not this is waiver or waivable or plain error, would you agree with me, or at least the statement, whether it's from me or not, that determination of the maximum sentence is a question solely within the province of the military judge? Would you agree with that statement? And regardless of who agrees or disagrees among the parties, isn't the actual determination solely in the province of the military judge?
Your Honor, I think I would agree that the military judge is the ultimate deciding authority of what the law is at a court-martial.
Yes, okay. Now, if that's the case, then on appeal, we often state in our cases that the military judge is presumed to know the law. And if that's the case, so now I got two things going here. If that's the case, then why isn't defense counsel allowed to presume that the military judge is correct in his or her statement of the law on maximum punishments or on maximum sentences?
It's an excellent question, Your Honor. I think the answer to that.
Well, that's probably a lousy question, but I appreciate it nonetheless.
No, I think the answer to Your Honor's question is simply that to hold otherwise incentivizes trial defense counsel to sit on their hands. And that is not the incentive that this court wants to create. This court should incentivize trial defense counsel to raise these issues at the lowest level possible where they can be most properly dealt with. If this court, were to incentivize appellants to sit idly by so that they can raise this issue on appeal, it creates a danger to the system in the sense that raising these issues on appeal results in delay. It may mandate or require a rehearing, and that rehearing is detrimental to the government and the justice system at large, because over time, memories fade, witnesses lose, are lost. And most importantly, in this case particularly, is the loss of witnesses, because this case involved illegal aliens within the confines of the United States, and they have since been deported. And so the government would not have access to those individuals for purposes of a rehearing if one were so required.
The government didn't have clean hands here. So you're trotting out this parade of horribles here, but this is not something that is on the back of the defense. So why should this court care at all, any of the factors you just mentioned?
Well, Your Honor, I think the court should care because where a defense counsel does not lodge an objection at the time of trial, it's misleading to the system and it creates this danger. And the government, while certainly responsible for some aspects of the military justice system, should not be held accountable for all errors, especially here, where all three parties reading the plain language of the statute arrived at exactly the same conclusion, that it permitted cumulative punishment on a per alien basis. And one reason why...
I know you have... Has you answered your question, Chief?
Yes.
On that question, let me ask you this. In this situation, could the government at trial have broken out the specifications so that there's a separate specification for each illegal immigrant? Could they have done that?
I think that's an open question, Your Honor. I think that there is...
Why couldn't they?
Well, because if you look at the plain language of the statute, the way that the punishment
forget the punishment part, just on military charging. In other words, could they have said, all right, we're going to have one specification for each individual illegal immigrant that was involved here that night, and there were five of them. Rather than making you answer my question there, let's assume that they could, all right, for the moment, just for the sake of my argument. Let's assume that they could. Then the next question is, would that be an unreasonable multiplication of charges?
To take your question in two parts, the answer to the first part of your question, Your Honor, is because the MCM dictates that when we're entering into sentencing, we sentence based on the offense, not simply the number of specifications. And I'm going to pivot back to the punishment okay. provision, but I promise you there's a reason. The punishment provision makes clear that this is, regardless of the number of aliens involved in a given transaction, the law treats it as a single violation or offense. Specifically, no more than 5 years confinement for each alien in respect to whom such a violation occurs. And I note that violation is singular. And if you look at the legislative history, which I know this court doesn't necessarily always like to look to, but it is informative in this particular aspect because the Congress has adopted the same language from transporting aliens into the smuggling aliens provision. And the smuggling aliens provision used to state that it was based on a transactional basis, per transaction. And in adopting this language, it's clear what they were doing was making this punishable on a per alien basis, regardless of the number of violations, which makes sense when you consider what the harm is in this particular crime. The harm here is that, you know, an illegal immigrant has entered into the, or is being transported throughout the United States in violation of the law. But there's a significant difference between a sedan containing 3 illegal aliens and a semi-truck containing 100 illegal immigrants in the back. And so to fully capture that harm, it has to be subject to a cumulative punishment.
Now, all that is fine and good, but what happens when all of those considerations in Title 18, or in this case Title 8, as they pertain to federal sentencing procedures, what happens when all of that meets the military system on sentencing? We have unreasonable multiplication of charges. We've got other kinds of things that the civilian systems don't have. And in this case, if this were to have been ruled an unreasonable multiplication of charges, assuming the government could break them out, what would be the remedy? What's usually the remedy when we have an unreasonable multiplication of charges? Doesn't the judge just say, all right, I'm going to collapse them all together, and this is going to be what the accused would get for one specification? Isn't that how our system works?
That would be how it would work under a UMC theory, Your Honor. I think it's important to note, with regard to UMC, appellant waived that objection as well. He'd never objected to that on that basis. An appellant in his brief also raises the duplicity issue, which was, again, waived because he didn't object to it at trial. But if let's look at duplicity, for example, the remedy for duplicity, let's assume that the court decides not to apply waiver to duplicity, the remedy for waiver is to break them into separate specifications. An appellant would be in exactly the same position as he is now, convicted of transporting 5 separate and distinct illegal immigrants throughout the United States. Here I don't believe that we have a UMC issue. And I don't believe that we have a duplicity issue because of the nature and the way that the law is crafted and that it treats it as a singular offense regardless of the number of individuals.
So your position, as I understand it then, is that in such a situation that the military judge is bound to the statutory reading of how the sentencing operates with regard to that specific federal statute.
Yes, Your Honor. When charging an assimilated federal crime under Article 134, the manual mandates that for determining the appropriate punishment, the military judge is to look to the punishing provisions in the language of the statute which is being assimilated.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, sir.
Yes, counsel, what would you rather this court? I'm sorry.
No, go.
What would you rather this court said, that the issue was waived or that there was no error on the merits?
I think, first and foremost, the court should find waiver. But in the alternative, should this court decline to enforce waiver in this case, then, of course, this court should find no plain error. But this raises an important point with regards to this court's doctrine regarding waiver. In United States versus Lee, this court laid out the limits of the waiver doctrine. And those limits, and in looking at Netter versus United States, which is a Supreme Court case, those cases stand for the proposition that the limits on the waiver doctrine are extremely limited. The limits of the waiver doctrine apply to issues where there is a structural issue or a structural defect that on its face creates a manifest injustice. So situations like in Dinger, where the appellant was sentenced to an illegal sentence, not a miscalculation, but an actual, honest-to-God, illegal sentence, or where the court lacks jurisdiction. These are two – an appellant cannot consent to expand the court's statutory authority. He cannot consent to expand the authority of the court to punish him. Those are items where this court will not apply waiver. But short of a structural defect and short of one that on its face creates a manifest injustice, this court's precedent and the Supreme Court's precedent stands for the proposition that the waiver doctrine should be applied. Much like this court did in United States v. Davis, while granted that was an instructional case and it was limited, not necessarily limited just to instructions, the same principles flow forth and this court should apply the principles from Davis here and find waiver. More importantly, I want to hit one more point that appellant brought up on in his argument, referencing United States v. Schmidt. And appellant's argument and citation to that case is self-defeating, because in Schmidt, while the court declined to enforce or utilize the waiver doctrine because the law was unsettled, also because the law was unsettled, this court determined that there could be no plain error because the law was unsettled. So even if this court, based on Schmidt, were to decline to apply the waiver doctrine, appellant still loses. Because if the law is unsettled, and that's this court's justification for declining to, enforce the waiver doctrine, then there could have been no plain error because the law was unsettled and the military judge, following the plain language of the statute, was not plain error.
Along those lines, I'd like for you, please, to provide your perspective on another argument that was made by appellant's counsel. And I don't wish to unintentionally mischaracterize it, but the gist of it was, for waiver, it needs to be knowing and intelligent, and that the way that Captain Brusick was talking about it was, needs to advance the trial strategy for there to be waiver. What is the government's reaction to that approach?
I disagree with that premise, Your Honor. There are a multitude of reasons why a trial defense counsel may not object. Many of them are for strategic purposes, but one reason why trial defense counsel may not object is because they don't believe that there's an error. They may have read the same statute that the government read and the military judge read and arrived at exactly the same conclusion. And that would not incentivize a defense counsel to object because it would be a frivolous objection. So to hold
the intelligent part there. If counsel is wrong, we've got the knowing part, but where's the intelligent part?
Well, I think the intelligent part, Your Honor, is if the law is unsettled, which the government doesn't believe that it is, but if the law is unsettled, there can be no, at least no plain error. But given that the law, at least in the government's position, is not unsettled, adhering to the plain language of the statute is intelligent and knowing. And one question this court could ask itself is whether this would constitute ineffective assistance of counsel. And it wouldn't. Because following and adhering to the plain language of the statute, where it does not lead to an absurd result, is the correct course of action. And so where a trial defense counsel looks at the plain language, says, yep, judge, I'm tracking that calculation, seems correct to me, that is knowing and intelligent because they've looked to the statute. And I think that's another important point to point out is that in the record, it wasn't just, is it 5 years? The first, it comes out in the form of a joint proposed instruction, tracking exactly the plain language and citing exactly to the provision in the federal code. But then the military judge breaks it down once they get close to sentencing and says, okay, so what I'm tracking is it's 5 years. We have five aliens that he was convicted of. 5 times 5 is 25. Does that track with what you're thinking, defense counsel? Yes, Your Honor. Okay, so we're looking at the conspiracy now, which would have the same punishment. So maximum punishment for everything he's been convicted of, 57 years and 2 months. Is that what you're tracking, defense counsel? Yes, Your Honor. So it's not that trial defense counsel didn't do their homework, that they didn't look at the law. They provided the law in the form of joint proposed instructions to the military judge, and he then applied that multiple times throughout the course of the proceeding and arrived at the right answer, which is why trial defense counsel did not object to trial. The no more than 5 years confinement for each alien in respect to whom such a violation occurs. It could not be more clear that what Congress did in enacting this provision is to permit cumulative punishment on a per alien basis. I see that my time is expiring. If there's any further questions,
any
if I may briefly
questions?
Conclude.
Please briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appellant affirmatively waived his right to raise the issue on three separate occasions. Even if he did not, there was no error, and certainly not one that was plain or obvious based on the plain language of the statute. This court should affirm the CCA's decision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Major Washburn. Captain Brusick.
Your Honor, members of the Court, I want to begin by addressing the issue of where we can look at the judges having placed the anchor for how they assess the sentence. The fact is that we don't know where the military judge began their analysis. We don't know because the record is silent as to how the military judge approached the issue of the maximum sentence calculation, except for the fact that he got it wrong. And that's what he went into sentencing with. So it's not a question of whether we can say he started at the bottom or he started at the top. It's that we just don't know. And that's the issue that the Supreme Court talked about in Molina Martinez, which is the reasonable probability that the military judge was influenced by that miscalculation. So that's the operative fact. It's that miscalculation that is the issue, and the absence of anything in the record to mitigate the extent that that miscalculation reasonably informed the sentence that the military judge imposed. I next want to address an issue with the question of whether the joint instructions and the agreement on the record as to the maximum sentence calculation was enough to affect waiver. And in United States versus Hardin, this court held that the military judge has the primary responsibility for getting that maximum sentence calculation correct. What the court went on to say further
wasn't that in the context of whether a plea was provident?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a case involving a guilty plea and the providence of a guilty plea. But the concerns in that case are even more so the case in one such as this, where we're dealing with contested findings and that there is no guilty plea. So there's not even a question of whether the accused could have benefited from a reduction in the maximum sentence which could be imposed per an agreement. It comes down to the military judge's understanding of what the maximum sentence is. But in United States versus Hardin, the court went on to explain that it wasn't the type of situation where defense counsel misled the court, such as the case here, where it's not that defense counsel was purposely misleading the court as to the maximum sentence calculation. It was defense counsel agreeing with the military judge's understanding and the government's understanding.
But counsel, how do you reconcile that when, let's say, the starting point was the joint proposal on instructions? And so it is not as if the military judge just announces, this is how I calculated it. It's you have this joint proposal that comes into the military judge. The military judge says, okay, I received this. You guys said it's 25 years. You agree it's 25 years.
Well, Your Honor, the military judge didn't base the maximum sentence calculation on the joint instruction. On the record, he said, I'm looking at 8 U.S.C. 1324.
Correct, but that wasn't the first touch. The first touch was the questions about the joint proposal. And so it throughout the trial, this issue was revisited multiple times. And so when the military judge, my understanding, my recollection, when the military judge was discussing 8 U.S.C., whatever, the 1324, you know, that was at least the second or the third time around.
Yes, Your Honor. And it's based on, and I can see my time is up, Your
Please
Honor.
Please respond to Judge Johnson.
That the military judge began with the question of what the party, well, specifically what the government had offered, and understanding that by that joint proposed instruction, yes, trial defense counsel appeared to agree, but it was still the military judge's primary responsibility to get the calculation correct. So if the parties were completely wrong, ultimately it was the military judge that had to do this, and the military judge did not correctly calculate the maximum sentence.
So what do we make, or what do you make of the government's argument that the law, well, government doesn't say it's unsettled, but clearly there's a circuit split with regards to how you do the calculation?
So the crucial issue here, Your Honor, it's a question of what the maximum sentence was, both based on the statute, but also based on the government's charging scheme. The government controlled the charge sheet. And duplicity is not a terribly controversial notion in military practice, that when multiple offenses are conjoined together, the maximum sentence is going to be limited based on that compound specification.
But as Judge Sparks, I think, noted, that the remedy for a duplicitous charge is that you separate out the specifications, and so the exposure of the accused would have been the same.
And, Your Honor, there understand that severance is what is seen as the remedy, but as this Court has explained, it's an unusual case where an accused would object to a duplicitous specification and seek severance, again, because it's to their benefit for that specification to remain conjoined.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, you may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that this Court find that the military judge committed plain error by failing to recognize the government's compound charging scheme. And because this went to a substantial right that was materially prejudiced, there was no waiver. Thank you.
The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the Court will stand in recess until 10:30.
Court stands at recess until 10:30.